This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to iFanboys Talksplode with writer-artist Phil Hester. Hey, this is Josh Flanagan with iFanboy.com, and this is our creator interview show that we call a Talksplode. This week, we're talking to prolific writer, artist, and comic book veteran Phil Hester about a lot of things. He has been around a long time. He's worked on a lot of comics in many ways, and it's just a great chat with a comic book vet who's still producing great work. So here's me and Phil. Hello, Phil.
Hi, Josh. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm excited to talk to you because I have actually been a really big fan of your work for a long time. And also, I don't know, you have like a different career than I think a lot of folks do. Sometimes I think of you as a writer, and sometimes I think of you as an artist. And you're just this thing in comics that's always there and does a lot of things to me. And I can't categorize you, and that's a good thing.
This poltergeist that cannot be exercised from the body of comics.
I think if you've proven anything else, that might be true.
No, it's a, yeah, I agree. I've never really separated those two things in my mind. I've always thought about it as just, you know, making comics. Mm-hmm. And it's just that at different points in my career, of those two skills, one would come to the fore and be of value in the marketplace and one wouldn't. So, you know, I just roll with, you know, where the opportunities come.
Well, I think it's interesting in that. So the first time I think I was aware of your work would have been with Kevin Smith writing.
Right.
And you were drawing Andy Parks on inks. And so that's the first thing I thought of. But I think the thing that's different about it is that you tend to either do one or the other. There's not a lot of times where you're writing and drawing. So you're sort of doing one or the other. And that's unusual now that I'm saying it out loud.
Yeah. It's kind of a conscious decision on my part. I try to, as a writer, I try to cast my projects impartially. Mm-hmm. You know, so if I'm cooking up an idea and I don't feel like I'm the right artist for it, I won't draw it. Mm-hmm. And very few of the of the ideas I've had for my creator-owned things, only a few have I thought I could probably draw this as well. Mm-hmm. Just a handful. It doesn't mean the person who ultimately drew it, if it wasn't me, didn't do a great job. In fact, the case that springs to mind most often is The Anchor. Mm-hmm. A book I did, a Boom, with Brian Chirilla. I feel like maybe I could have drawn that. That's sort of in my wheelhouse, mm-hmm. but you know, not as well as Brian did. But yeah, I try to be impartial about my own skill set. And there's only a handful of books that I feel like I've written and should be drawing at the same time.
Do you feel like you're drawing has sort of a different tone, like creates a different type of comic books than, say, your writing does?
Oh, yeah. I think my, I don't know, my writing tends to be sort of like kind of always veer toward navel-gazing existential stuff. And my art tends to be a little more exuberant.
That's about
even right. Even when it's a superhero, you know, I can never marry like the two impulses that sort of formed my style, which is I really love those bright, shiny, like bouncy cartoonists of my youth, like Joe Staton or John Byrne. But I also could not get enough of, you know, Bernie Wrights and Richard Corbin and Gene Colan. So, you know, I was trying to merge those two, two disparate styles. And what you get in the middle is me, which is neither of those styles. You know, you get something that is, I mean, when it's trying to be graceful is still sometimes blocky. And when it's trying to be scary is still sometimes a little funny, you know? So there's always going to be, there's always this like sort of discontinuity or, you know, in all my work. And it, I'd like to say it's intentional. I'm not sure if it's intentional or not, but I can live with it and I've learned to use it. And I think it's what makes me stand out from even the people that do work in a style similar to mine.
It's true, I think, because like I said, the first thing I would have thought of that I became familiar with you would have been Green Arrow, which is, for lack of a better word, kind of cartoony. I tend to think of it that way. And I don't use that in a bad way.
No, I don't take it that way. A lot of people do, but I don't.
And then I think the first couple of times I bought your creator-owned projects, I was like, oh, he's dark. And I don't know that I've ever reconciled that to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I've spoken with you, I've chatted with you. You don't seem like a particularly dark, gloomy person, but
you know,
your creator-owned written stuff that I've read, it can be grim.
That's how I get it out, I guess.
I guess. That works better that way.
Well, how many people do you know that draw like the most mainstream superhero stuff or write the most mainstream superhero stuff that are just like the most twisted people on earth?
That's true.
You know, when you get to talk to them. I don't want to like sort of diagnose people based on their work. But I just feel like that's the stuff that moves me. And I just try to like go where the inspiration leads. And even, you know, I think my last big creator-owned thing was a book called Mythic that I did with John McCrae. And although it had horror elements to it, it was definitely like a book that was heavy on humor.
Yeah.
And
even a bit of a procedural almost, but in a silly world.
Right. Right. A very silly world. And I wrote another book that's a very similar book to that called Golly, but that's sort of in that same vein, but a little more, you know, deep fried redneck kind of book.
It's funny, as we talk about this stuff, you've done a lot of different things, a lot of little creator owned things here and there.
I'm waiting for one of them to succeed.
Fire Breather wasn't so bad for you.
In the end, I'm probably measuring myself against the wrong yardsticks. I should not be competing with, in my mind, I shouldn't be competing with Kirkman and Mark Miller and people like that.
Well, it's hard not to in the way the comics is talked about.
It's like, oh man, I don't have an empire yet. Mm-hmm. I blew it. just getting to do the book that you want to do without compromising. And then if you put it out and like 10,000 people buy it, that's exciting to me. I can make a career out of that.
And it seems like you are.
Yeah, apparently.
That's kind of been a thing. The other thing that's interesting to me is that you work with a lot of different people. You work with a lot of different publishers. Again, I was going through sort of reading up on the stuff that you've done. We're talking about what you were doing now. And you're all over the place and not in a bad way. So that leads me to the assumption, you know, people must like working with you. That's what I've decided.
I hope so. I mean, that's sort of a goal of mine, is to have, like, even places that I don't, that I've, like, broken up with on, like, on completely justifiable terms, I still feel guilty about. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, oh, you know, it's a Midwestern thing I've got going on. But, yeah, I'd like to be seen as somebody that's, like, fun to work with and, mm-hmm. and produces rewarding work. But also, you know, for the people that don't know how the business works, you know, you can be with a publisher that loves your work and wants to work with you all the time. And you just can't find something that clicks with them. Like, to go back to Boom and The Anchor, we had The Anchor was a great experience for everybody. And I know a bunch of people there, and I'm friendly with all those people. And we keep intending to do a book together, and it just hasn't happened because I haven't pitched them the thing that's been just right for them. But it has been just right for other places. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have a finite amount of time left in my career to work. So, you know, you have to go where the project's accepted. You can't just say, I'm a dark horse. I wish I had that Mike Mignola dynamic where I'm like, you know, I'm a dark horse guy. I'm going to, you know, Dark Horse is going to do my big magnum opus, and that's going to take me for the rest of my career. But number one, I don't think I have a franchise-like idea like that. And I think I'm happier jumping around from project.
Would you want to do that? Because you've done a lot of miniseries and stuff, so it seems like
I'm kind of faithless. I mean, I really admire the people that could do like Larson doing Savage Dragon or Terry Moore doing Strangers in Paradise, and they do them forever. And I'm like, I don't know if I have an idea like that. Like, even the stuff that I really love, that I wish I could keep doing forever. Like, I could have done Fire Breather almost indefinitely. Mm-hmm. But Kirkman's doing with Invincible, you know, I saw an end there, you know, and it was probably about 30 issues mm-hmm. instead of the, you know, dozen we got out.
Right.
I like to write endings. So I don't know if I have like a big, I definitely do not have a 300 issue opus in me.
Well, if you think about it, something like, I mean, 24 issues on a flawless run is 2 years, which is not insignificant. So, you know, I mean, do you find that you just get bored of one thing and you want to do a different thing?
No, I don't get bored. I feel like there's a natural arc to like the story and the characters, and I want to find it and tell it, you know, one of the creator and things I've done that has gotten at least a lot of attention from other professionals is a book I did with Mike Cuddleston called The Coffin. And we get asked to do sequels to that all the time, and we just don't want to because we're happy with it. You know, it's got an ending that we liked and we're done, you know.
It's interesting because I'm going to assume, did you grow up reading sort of mainstream superhero comics?
Oh, yeah. I read everything, though. Yeah. I mean, I read everything I could get my hands on, in terms of regular books and comics. So I was reading, at 13, I was reading Superman Family and Heavy Metal, you know. As soon as I could get into a head shop, I was buying underground books, mm-hmm. you know. I was the only kid in there just buying comics, but you know, I went to head shops just to get Richard Corbin comics.
I completely understand that. Yeah. It's funny. You really, I think you are that sort of typical, Midwestern, a contradiction to yourself almost. Like, you're super nice and friendly and everything, but the other's like, I want to see that really weird comic.
Yeah. I did. And like, so when the black and white explosion took place, not the explosion, I would say the first trickles of that sort of street level comics like Nexus and Love and Rockets and Cerebus, I was in high school when those all kicked in. And to me, that was super exciting because I love mainstream superhero comics, but I always just bent to the weirder mm-hmm. end of it. And so seeing something like Cerebus come out, was just like, oh, that's totally what I'm about. This something is just a little bit off kilter, but still like really engaging storytelling. So Yeah, I was drawn to, if you went through my comic collection even today, it would be, I think the word would be indiscriminate. Mm-hmm. Like I'm like that music blogger that you don't believe really buys bluegrass and hip hop. Mm-hmm. That's me, but for comics.
Do you tend to find the thing you like in everything, or do you tend to be a critical reader?
I'm a critical reader, mm-hmm. But there's something about comics that can pull me through it. There's something that's just so engaging and immediate about it that I'm really tough on novels.
Right.
And if a novel's not like, not only really well, like a great story, but really well written, or at least really interestingly written, I bail. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't need it. But if a comic is a hot mess, but there's one aspect of it that I find engaging, I'll stick around, you know?
Yeah.
I'll stick to the end. I'm just hardwired. I'm sort of hardwired for that, I think.
So what are the sort of earliest comics that really grabbed you and you know, made you start to think about, I want to do this?
I always read comics as far back as I can remember, but I remember being really, really thrilled by Joe Staton's E-Man comic from Charlton that came out in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, really sort of both kind of like repulsed, but really turned on by Wayne and Wright's and Swamp Thing Run, which my kind of hippie uncles had in their collection. And I would sort of pilfer their collection and read. And then when I got older, I went back and bought my own copies. But those books really, and I loved Kirby stuff when I was a kid, even though when I was really little, I thought he drew weird. But, you know, about the age 11 or so, I thought, this is weird but cool. And these ideas are like nothing else anywhere in comics. And then when I was in, I would say junior high, maybe, yeah, I think it was in junior high when Frank Miller started on Daredevil. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was like, oh, here's one guy doing it all. And it's really cinematic and really dramatic. And the drawing style is really like high contrast and really muscular. And this something I wish I could do. And maybe I will try to do that now, because I always drew as a kid. And I even drew my own comics as a kid for myself. But when I was reading those Daredevils, that's when it sort of cemented in my mind that I would pursue that as a career path.
It's funny that you say that, because I was just looking through some artwork and I can actually see that shadow, that dark stuff. Because again, I, for whatever reason, you know, whatever your first impression is of somebody, that's sort of what it is. And so I tend to think of that cartoony style, but I was looking, I think there's some black and white images from Shipwreck up on the Aftershock site.
Oh, right.
And I was like, there's a lot of shadow in that. There's a lot of sort of black area.
And if you go back and look at, if you go back and look at Green Arrow, mm-hmm. The figures are cartoon. I mean, like they're more cartoony than say, you know, Gary Frank's work or whatever, but it's, there's still a lot of black on those images. I mean,
my instinct is to put it in, is to lump it in with something like a Darwin Cook or something, but it's not that. It was what I was.
Yeah, no, but it's, I'm from that neighborhood.
Right.
I'm not as assured as he is, but like, yeah, but we're both from that sort of, the continent of Bruce Timm.
He told me once, I said, when I was a kid, I wanted to draw sort of like he did. I remember always trying to draw like a Disney character, and it was just that economy. It was like line, line, line. They're all right where they're supposed to be. And I said, I couldn't ever get it. And then I basically ended up quitting because I was like, I can't do what I want to. And he's like, you should have kept going. And I was like, oh, it's the smartest thing anyone's ever said to me. It's just like, I just needed more practice, but nobody was there to tell me that as a kid.
It is. It's a lot of it's practice.
I needed Darwin Cook to tell me that in 2014, which was too late.
Too late, dude.
It turns out.
I think, you know, you see kids draw and they don't care if they're good or not. Mm-hmm. You know, they just want to do it. They want to express themselves. And then it slowly gets leached out of them that, you know, that they're good at it or not.
Well,
sort of,
you know,
like planes. Like
that was, I don't know that that was the thing. Like I had, you know, I had the How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way, like anybody, and I would try to draw like that, and I just couldn't. And if I was smarter, I'd have known, you know, like that's not necessarily going to be your natural style, or that's the thing, or you can figure it out. But
well, I have breaking news for you.
Yeah,
Josh.
I know.
Nobody draws the way they want to draw.
I know.
You know, like.
Then I got interested in skateboarding, which turned out, you know, not to be as lucrative.
Well, I mean, like nobody, like people working in the business don't draw the way they want to draw. Everyone's got a different idea in their head about the way they want their work to look and the way it does look.
Well, let me ask you this. So you were drawing all the time. You started to get, you started to get more interested in comics. You know, what was the point that you got serious where you said, this is a thing I want to do as a career?
In high school, probably. In high school, I started making my own comics with my friends. And I don't mean
about
like
when?
In high school.
So how old, or what year about are we talking about?
Oh, like in the early 80s, like Stranger Things era.
Okay.
Like
the
I'm
context
exactly,
of the comics coming out of the time for me.
I'm the exact age of the older kids on Stranger Things.
Okay.
We started, I started making not just a few comics, like I made I put myself on a schedule and I had deadlines and I had different genres that I had to do. I did horror comics, superhero comics, humor comics. And I pretended like I had a little publishing empire. And because I was from this little high school, my friends were into it and I would wind up, you know, making photocopies of all these little mini comics and giving them out to my friends. And it became a habit to me then. And then when I got into college, I still kept making comics just with a different set of friends. And then the Turtles happened while I was in college. And overnight, like, you know, anybody that had a visa could become a publisher. And back then, you know, if you printed anything, you were guaranteed to sell like 15,000 copies of it. So you can make money printing garbage. And luckily I could draw garbage. And that's when I started working professionally. When I was I think between my sophomore and junior years of school, I submitted the work that got me work. And then during my junior year in college, I started drawing professionally. And then when I was about 23, or 24, I quit my day job and have not had a day job since.
What did you go to school for?
I have a BFA in drawing.
Okay. So that was, you were totally, there was no backup plan.
Yeah. No, that was it. But although, you know, it was a different time back then and there wasn't really that much respect for comics back then, especially in art school. And I'm glad my professors made me sort of veer away from that and sort of make myself a more rounded artist. And it really broadened my horizons and made me ready for all the wild comics that started coming out around that time. And let me push my own aesthetic into doing stranger and stranger stuff too. So, I'm really glad that I went to school at that time instead of going to say like, the Joe Kubert School, although that would have been great. And it would have been great for my career. And the people that do go to school there learn a lot of cool stuff about making comics. I'm glad I went to a traditional art school that made me sort of broaden my horizons. Yeah, because I went to art school. I went to art school with, you know, Frank Frazetta being my favorite artist. And I graduated with, you know, Mark Rothko being my favorite artist. So
yeah, that's quite a leap. But there was something valuable about that then? You still use the things that you learned from that?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, oh, yeah. Mostly about how to talk about my work and defend my work and how to think critically about not only my work but other people's work. Mm-hmm.
And I bet you're one of the only people who graduated that and is still making art for a living.
Yeah, that's another thing. I reconnected with one of my own professors and he's like, wow, I'm glad somebody didn't go broke, you know? Somebody's actually make a living doing this.
To go back just a little bit, when you were making your own comics, as we know, there wasn't an internet at that point.
Right.
What did you do about sort of learning some of the stuff about comics, like how to actually make them, as opposed to just sort of copying what you saw, or were you just making up as you went along?
I was winging a lot of it. I didn't know, like, for instance, I think I was in college before I knew that comics were not drawn print size. I hadn't been to a convention, you know, and there was no internet, and I'd never seen a piece of original art. So I didn't know they were drawn 1.5 up. Mm-hmm. So that was news to me. I was like, oh, that's how you get everything in there. It's bigger. But when Comic Scene came along, and then I found the Comics Journal as well, and then the CBG, you know, sort of that sort of fan slash pro, that sort of pro-am magazines that were out at the time. It was really cool to see that window into how comics were actually made. And then, of course, How to Draw Comics and Marvel Way came out. And I got that for a Christmas present, and I still have it.
Yeah, I have my copy, too.
Yeah.
And somewhere I have a notebook of everything I tried to copy out of it.
A lot of people bag on it, but it's a pretty good text.
Oh, I learned a ton from it. And then, you know, after sort of doing this and, you know, talking about comics professionally for a better part of over a decade, actually, you know, like it, you know, it still holds up. Like, there's a lot in there that I wish I'd read closer, because I would have understood what I was reading a lot more, I think. But it's a great book. And it's so many people was their touchstone.
Oh, yeah. But it was it was a lot of, you know, catch as catch can. And then in college, I finally started going to conventions here and there, and just seeing how people did things and picking up that way.
So what was your day job that you got to quit?
I worked at a newspaper. This is going to tell you how old I am. I worked at a newspaper back when newspapers were physically pasted up.
Oh, wow.
So we lay out the layout pages, and then we'd actually print the columns and, you know, wax them onto the, you know, the boards, and then send those boards to the printer. So yeah, I was a paste up guy, and I drew ads and I drew political cartoons, and it was for a little small town newspaper. But yeah, that was my day job from like 21 to 24. And cool. I was still doing comics then. Mm-hmm. Especially like I'd get home at night and do comics. And, but once I got my first Marvel gig at like 23, and then I walked into work and I was like, good day to you. You know, I was like, I'm done. I'll never darken your door again. And 'cause I thought, oh, well, I got a Marvel job. It's never going to end. It's going to be a constant, you know, the tap has been opened. And, you know, 6 months later, I was like, oh my God, back. All these companies that I previously mentioned that started with a credit card, they started running into, you know, the end game of that system as well. And so I was starting to do work for companies that weren't paying me. And I was like, oh my God, I have to go back to that day job. And I did go back for a little while and then quit again later. But
with the same panache?
No, a little more humility. That was more of a see you later, maybe.
So at that point, so when you start doing professional comics, it becomes your thing. Did you have like a goal in mind, a thing you wanted to do? Was there not an end game, but was there sort of a kind of career that you wanted to have, or were you just?
Yeah, rolling? I thought I would have. I really wanted Frank Miller's career. I really wanted to be somebody that could do sort of landmark work as a writer and an artist, mm-hmm. And then also transition to just writing if I wanted to. Because not only did, you know, Daredevil come out when I was in high school, but then in college, Dark Knight and Year One came out, like bam, bam. Mm-hmm. Like, and Born Again, you know, just like a tidal wave. And Watchmen came out around that time too, but I was always more like, oh no, this stuff's above that. This is more, you know, this is more pure comics. And I really wanted that career, and I'm 51, but deep down I still do. Like, I feel like I will be a failure unless I have a signature run on a book that I write and draw, like a mainstream book. I don't know if that's ever going to happen. I'm probably more likely to do one or the other. but you know, that's still like a, and all the, on all the indie stuff I've done since then, to me has been super satisfying as well. And that's something that wasn't quite available to a generation that's a little bit older than me. They didn't have that access to like doing those indie books. So like, I feel like that's a facet that I didn't anticipate that's been like more rewarding than I thought it would be.
Yeah. And it didn't, and it also didn't exist for, I mean, it didn't exist for the people before, but also that sort of industry-wide game changer thing is a different, I don't even know if that could exist in the same way now.
Right.
I mean, they're in a way, there are a lot of little Frank Millers now.
Yes, exactly. I think you're right there. Hmm. Yeah. And it's, yeah, I mean, while we're like every, like sort of every entertainment medium, we're all narrow casting now, you know, we're, there's no more ABC movie of the week that everybody has to watch. Instead, everyone can find exactly what they want. And so you can put out a book that sells 5,000 copies, but if it sells 5,000 copies every month, you'll be all right, you know, because it's found its audience. Or you can put out a book that, or you can do a project like Girls with Slingshots, you know, that never sells itself at all. It's just a web strip, but garners such a loyal, magnificent audience that it can do a $250,000 Kickstarter.
So it's, I'm trying to, so how do you see sort of where you're fitting in, I guess, with like with comics now, in that you've seen it change in this way and you are, And I, this is not supposed to, you know, you're in the middle of your career. I was going to say middle age, but about 6 months ago, my doctor said, technically you're middle age. And I was like, oh God, I wish you had never said that to me. But you know, the reality of it is this industry hasn't been super kind to the longevity of people who are, you know, working comic book creators. How have you been able to find a niche for that and keep going? Cause you have been, and that's really impressive.
Yeah. I think by never being popular, that probably helped me.
I was not setting you up for that. I'm sorry.
No, I think if you never peak, you know, you're never going to crash. Like instead, I'll just be like, you know, I'll be this guy that's always at the party. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm always like, you know, getting ice or whatever. But as long as I'm useful at the party, they're not going to tell me to leave. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like if I just, you know, if I can maintain you know, a living doing, you know, mainstream stuff, which I also really enjoy. Mm-hmm. Like that. I love mainstream superhero comics, but if that keeps me afloat, you know, so that I can do my weird creator and stuff, then I'm completely satisfied. And yeah, you're right. It isn't like, there's not a ton of dudes who are my age that are, you know, drawing regular books now or writing, you know, there's more people writing them, but there's not a ton of dudes my age that are drawing regular books.
Do you think that is because the tastes of the audience are fickle, or even the
it's a little of both.
And then there's also sort of the, it takes a certain kind of hunger and a certain kind of love. And I think for a lot of people that fades. So what keeps you moving?
Well, it's more than hunger. It takes a certain kind of time commitment that young people are able to give that you're not able to give once you start having family obligations. So like the older you get, like the more of a, the harder it is. Like there's this theory that like everybody's pencil to paper time is the same when it comes to drawing. Mm-hmm. You know, your, the amount of time you spend with your pencil or your brush on the paper is all about the same. What's really different is your ass to seat time, you know, and whether you're off playing, you know, World of Warcraft, or you're off coaching softball, whatever, like certain things can pull you away from that. And the older you get, the more things are pulling you away from that. Mm-hmm. So it gets harder and harder to like, just like say, I'm going to draw comics for 18 hours. Like mm-hmm. when, you know, when you're 24, you can do that. When you're 44, you cannot do that. There are too many things pulling at you. So it becomes harder to, you know, and drawing comics is hard. I don't know if you know this, but it's tough. There's a
I'm aware.
I mean, it's not hard. It's not as hard as, like, you know, digging a ditch, but it's still hard. I mean, it's
well, it, I mean, I think we've seen a lot lately, and I know we can talk about your health issues that affected that, but also just in general, I think you're hearing a lot more people talk about the sort of ongoing effects. Guys who I think of as young, who are, you know, entering their 10th year or something like that, drawing companies, like, they're starting to feel it. And because there's that gung-ho attitude of draw, and people are killing themselves doing it.
Yeah, it's this weird combination of, well, in America, there's this, you know, toxic masculinity about, like, you know, I got to kill myself to earn for my family, you know? And in comics, there's sort of it's compounded by this toxic romantic aspect.
Yeah, it's like the nerd version of tough guy. Right.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, I stayed up two nights in a row to finish this. That's nothing. I, it's, so we've got that double whammy going on for a lot of, for me at least, that was the double whammy in effect. Hopefully with more women cartoonists entering the field, they can sort of weed some of that, the toxic masculinity part of it out. But they're still going to be subject to that romance at the deadline, you know. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the hard living cartoonist ideal. Both those things are sort of like really stupid and unsustainable. And so I think what you're talking about, how a lot of people my age aren't still doing this, is because a lot of people hit 40 and go, this is not worth it.
Yes.
You know, the pay is not, you know, the pay is not up to the amount of work it is. And it really isn't. Even on a good book, even on a book that's making a lot of royalties, you can make a lot more in advertising or video game design or things like that. So you really have to love it. You have to, like, love it on sort of an unhealthy level. And I am not cured. So.
Well, and I think that's interesting. I think that's one thing, just from watching you talk about art, watching you talk about comics and social media, things like that, you have a fairly healthy addiction to original art you know, belies a pretty strong love of the art form still that's stuck around.
Oh, which definitely.
I think you know, like, so you still have, it's almost like you weren't jaded in the way that lot of people get.
I can recognize the BS, but there's still enough magic underneath that all. It'd be the same thing if you worked in, like, popular music or mm-hmm. film. You know, there's so much, it's fraught with so much garbage. But part of the reason it's fraught with so much garbage is that, like, everyone's there. It's like the garbage left over after a festival, you know?
Yeah.
Everyone's there for the same thing that they all love. But anytime you get that many people together, there's going to be a lot of crap. So, it's sort of, that's comics in a nutshell. And seeing the real world and seeing, you know, people deal with, like, finance and politics or grown up real jobs. It's 100 times worse in those places. Mm-hmm. The garbage is so much worse in those places. At least comics, there's still this sort of, like, deep down, there's, like, this innocent kernel of, we just want to see these pictures tell stories, you know, and that's something that's with us from childhood. Right. Mm-hmm. From being read to as kids. And so we sort of, if you can keep that little spark alive, I think you can hang on all the way till you're an old man like me.
Well, what do you love about comics now that you didn't, that took you a while to sort of, you know, understand about it, or why that you loved it? Does that make sense?
I'm sorry. You dropped out on me a little bit there too. So go ahead. Try that again.
Is there something about comics that you have sort of grown to love about it that you maybe didn't necessarily know about when you were younger? And I will give you an example.
Okay.
It took me, you know, I've been running this website since 2000. You know, we did it full time for a little while. It took me a long time to learn how to talk about art and what made it work. And at some point, the mechanics of storytelling, which I know were exactly the thing that you had to work on for the beginning, I started to understand it, and I started to see it and be able to talk about it. And now that really is the thing that I look for the most in comics, the things that I appreciate most about it. It took me a long time to sort of learn it and understand it. You know, that wasn't what I was looking at when I was a kid. When I was a kid, you know, oh, that looks cool, but I didn't know why. Is there anything that, as a professional, that really still makes you excited about comics?
Yeah, I mean, the thing, and this goes back to me being sort of an indiscriminate buyer of comics as well, is that, like, there are artists and styles and genres that I did not like when I was young. Mm-hmm. And I've grown to appreciate over time. I want to say that, like, but that all happened really young. Like, sure. Like, I want to say there were certain artists like Pat Boyette that I was, like, repulsed by, mm-hmm. when I was a kid, but I got over that one, you know, by the time I was 20, you know, and I started to see what was exciting about his work. And now I'm a huge fan of his, and I own almost a dozen of his originals. But I think the longer I stick around, the more value I can find in work that I don't like. So like something does not have to, like, strike me as like, oh, I love this, you know, right. Like this doesn't, something does not have to be in my wheelhouse for me to learn from it. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a rewarding experience. I can't point to any specific things and say, this is something I like now that I didn't like before. Mm-hmm. All I can say is, like, the more I'm exposed to, the more I feel like I'm my tastes are broadening even more, until eventually I'll be a perfect flat plane and not be able to ascertain the good or bad in anything.
We can all hope for that wonderful numbness.
That's my existentialist ending to that whole thing.
I have nothing else to ask. Well, you know, it's interesting.
I'm on a journey to obliterate my own personal taste.
There's something valuable in that. I'm not sure what, but I feel like if anything, it'll save you money from buying art.
Right.
Well, it's interesting because I'm about 10 years younger than you. So all of that stuff that you were talking about, you know, mid 80s, 86, the year they changed comics, blah, blah, blah. You know, I was 9, 10 when that happened. So it kind of went over my head. And I remember being 10 or 11 years old and looking at Bill Sienkiewicz and going, what the hell? Why does anyone like this? You know?
Yeah.
And then later I went, oh, you know, as soon as it actually, what it took for him, was as soon as I saw him ink somebody else and see how that transformed that. And it all instantly clicked into place.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, there's my story for the people interested.
No, I understand it completely. Yeah. And it's, for most people, it's largely a function of age. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're a kid, you sort of have very specific, you know, you're just a raw, you know, you're just raw sensor that is like, okay, I like this, I don't like that. You're basically like a little push button. And then when you get older, you know, certain things are, your tastes change and you're able to appreciate more.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about this original art thing that you have. Mm-hmm. What kind of a collection are we talking about here? And I'm not trying to invite Joe Quesada's workman over to your house or anything like that. So,
yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's
what do you do with it? Is it just in binders?
It's in flat files. Uh-huh. I have flat files, so I don't expose them to light. And I just get them out and look at them every once in a while, and I learn from them. And it's also something that I know a lot about. So, sure. I know where the trends in the market are going and what's a good investment and what's not. I buy nothing as an investment, but I rationalize things.
I understand that completely.
As investments. But I try to find the artists that really meant a lot to me. And if you go to Comic Art Fans and look at my collection, you'll see that a lot of artists mean a lot to me.
Mm-hmm. And has that evolved over the years? Like, has that sort of changed? I mean, I assume there's a couple of stalwart favorites.
I started buying Kirby and Miller. That was like my main thing, was like, I want those guys. And when I started, those were attainable goals. You know, they were not cheap, but they were still, it was still like possible to get those guys. Whereas today it is not, mm-hmm. Unless you're a hedge fund manager. So it's, it started out as like, I'm going to get the guys that inspired me. And then it sort of, I kept thinking, well, this person also inspired me, mm-hmm. you know, and this person did too. And then it sort of became like, I want at least one from everybody who's inspired me.
Mm-hmm.
And then
did you two-part?
I find that's an exhaust.
Two-part question, I guess. Did you find, like, is there a white whale that you finally got, and is there one that you still don't have?
Yeah, the other one's easier to answer. I really want a Jim Steranko story page. Mm-hmm. I have a Jim Steranko, like, cover rough, but I don't have a page with his storytelling on it, because I think he was like an atomic bomb to storytelling, you know, in the 60s. He just really changed the game for everybody. And even though he did not a huge amount of work, you know, like, his actual page count's not that high. Mm-hmm. Every one of his pages, it was sort of a revelation. So I'd love to get a page from him. It's going to be a chore to do that because they're very expensive.
Is that a recent thing, or is that like have they always been expensive, or have they just, have they, yeah, they've always,
I don't know how this worked. It's always been, it's the way everything works. It's always just out of your grasp, no matter how much money you make. It's always, it keeps advancing, so you can never catch it. Mm-hmm. So, like, when I started collecting comics, and, you know, a Jack Kirby, Joe Sinnott Fantastic Four page was like $800 when I started collecting art. Mm-hmm. And now they're, you know, $30,000. So,
guitars are the same way. Actually, it's exactly the same thing. Everything.
It's just like the more disposable income you have, the more out of reach those things are going to be. Yeah. But as far as, like, it's hard for me to say. I mean, I've changed from just wanting like examples of my favorite artists to wanting examples from meaningful storylines from those artists. So previously, like just recently, it was enough for me to have a Mike Zeck Captain America page. Wow. But then I was like, you know what? I really want a Mike Zeck Kraven's Last Hunt page. So I went out and got one of those. So that's sort of like where my collection is going now. I'm trying to find like pages for more meaningful, mm-hmm. or upgrading my example. Like I have a Gosuke Kojima, Lone Wolf and Cub sketch. It's never going to happen, cause I don't know, I don't think they exist. And if they do, they never leave Japan, but like a story page from him would be the upgrade I'd be looking for, if you know what I mean.
Sure. I do. Is that a thing that doesn't exist? Like, they're not out there that people know about?
Oh, no. I've never seen one, so I can't tell you.
That's really interesting.
I've only seen his sketches that he did for people, and that's, I've got one of those. Mm-hmm.
So. Do you collect anything new, or is it all old?
Oh, yeah. I collect new artists all the time. I'm always looking for new artists. Mm-hmm. And there's so many really, like in a short span, I think I've only got two James Herron, but
oh, he's amazing.
I'm always looking to buy more James Herron. You know, if certain artists come along and they're interesting, I try to jump on them before they're expensive.
Herron sort of seems to be like in an area that's similar to your art. I think I can see there's a thing going on.
Except there. For usually really good.
I wasn't going for that. I was just putting in a family. Well, he is amazing. He's one of those. As soon as I saw him, I went, oh, that's he's a special thing.
Yeah, he's amazing. Yeah, I got a really good page from Rumble, mm-hmm. and then a BPRD page. So yeah, he's a really special talent.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm always on the lookout for people like that, and I'm always buying. And the range is, you know, I'll buy underground cartoonists if I like. Or I guess there's not really an underground anymore, but. I'll buy non-mainstream cartoonists if they have interesting work, you know.
Is this a monthly thing? Is it like, how often are you picking up artwork?
Is this an intervention or
no? I'm just curious. I know it's hard to get by as a comic book artist. I was like, how much art are we talking about here? Do you trade? Like, do you buy and sell so that you can fund other things?
Yes. I sell my own work. And that's sort of the rationale I have, is that if I'm selling my own work, that's stuff I can use to fund my collection. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've gone from buying, you know, at my peak, I was buying a lot of stuff every month, and now I'm trying to pick my shots a little bit better, mm-hmm. and just getting, So instead of buying like something cool every, you know, every 3 weeks, I'll buy something I really want like every 3 or 4 months, you know, like a bigger investment.
Yeah. And the reason I ask is literally, I'm just whatever I'm interested in the moment. I'm like, I really want to get more of that. And I find it's hard to slow down and stop and do the same thing. So,
well,
I very quickly dip my toe into original art. Like, I want to say early 2000s, I started buying some pages. And again, they were cheaper then. It was like, you know, between 100, 200 bucks, you could get some pretty cool stuff. I think I have a page from the first issue of Transmetropolitan.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Beautiful, fully leathered, you know, which is a thing that I miss. Mm-hmm. I don't like new pages as much because of it. I think maybe $150 I paid for it.
Yeah, it was a different time.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I have a page from an imminent page from Next Wave that I paid $75 for.
And yeah, his stuff, he's one of those people that is still criminally undervalued, I think, in the original art market.
I didn't even want the page all that much, but I was like, come on, it's imminent. As good a storyteller as exists.
Oh, yeah. And he can, but I don't understand why. I mean, it might be because he's so ubiquitous. There's just so much of his stuff out there that people don't think it's precious yet. But I don't know. He's still a bargain in the original market.
Well, get on that. Mine's Steve Rogers breaking a toilet, which is also
You gotta love that.
Yeah, you can't not. anyway, so let's talk a little bit about what you're going on now. Now, I asked you sort of what you're working on, and you gave me a huge list. And for a guy,
I left stuff off of it.
I know.
How much I'm doing. I forget stuff.
So it doesn't make sense to me. I don't have it in front of me, but you said you're doing Batman Beyond. You're drawing Shipwreck. You're writing and drawing something. It was a lot of work, and I don't understand how you're doing that.
Yeah. Well, my kids are grown now and out of the house, so they're in college. So it's a little bit easier to devote more of my time to doing comics. Mm-hmm. And I don't do all those at the same time. Like Shipwreck is done when Warren gets around, you know, he's got a lot of obligations, so he's not working on it constantly. So like right now I'm not working on Shipwreck because there's no script to work on. So I can fill those holes with other assignments and my own work and stuff like that. So when I hit you with that big wave of projects,
stuff that's out now, really.
Some of the stuff is done. Some of it's not done yet. You know, so like when I mentioned I'm laying out Teen Titans, I think to you, I'm done laying out Teen Titans, and you know, I think they're done coming out. But that's a recent thing I've done. You know, so I decided to mention it, but you know, I forgot stuff like just today I finished a Green Arrow Black Canary holidays, a short story for the Justice League holiday special. Nice. You know, and I'm so busy I didn't even remember to mention it. So you know, you just gotta keep rolling. But yeah, it's you know, I'm writing Blood Blister for Aftershock, and I am I'm writing a thing for Oni that we're not even talking about yet because it's so far away from coming out. I think I'll be writing some fill-in issues of various stuff for DC over the next few months. I'm writing an arc of Future Quest, you know, the Hanna-Barbera adventure book that DC has. I'll be writing a Birdman-centric arc of that that Steve Rude is drawing, which is pretty exciting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Don't get on his bad side. You don't have to respond to that.
No, I don't want to give it. He's like my hero. So
is he?
Yeah.
Have you gotten to work with your heroes a lot? You've had a long career, so you've sort of gotten to span eras.
I got to meet them. I mean, even if I didn't get to work with them, I got to meet a lot of them, which is pretty exciting. I think probably the one that I've made the biggest connection with is probably Matt Wagner. You know, he's the guy. Mage was coming out, you know, first coming out when I was in college. So that book meant a lot to me. And getting to actually, like, know him, like, as a friend has been pretty exciting. Because, you know, I've met other people. You know, like, I've met, you know, Stan Lee and Frank Miller and people like that. But I actually have a relationship with Matt, which is pretty exciting to me.
Yeah, that's actually been one of the it's one of the best parts that I've had sort of, you know, working around comics, is that like I've met a lot of people who I like them a lot. And more often than not, it really hasn't been a, like, comics professionals are like kind of my favorite people of all the kinds of people I've met in the world, mostly.
Right. Like, that whole don't meet your heroes thing doesn't really apply to comics. There's only like a handful of people that I had a bad interaction with. And then even those people, I kind of like, you know, maybe they had a bad day.
Yeah.
You know, maybe
I was able to figure that out in retrospect. I was like, I don't think he was a jerk. I think he was just hungry.
Right. Or he didn't recognize me or something, you know?
Yeah.
Because that's something I was
one of the things I wrote down ahead of time. It was like, if I saw you at a show, now I've met you, but I don't think I would recognize you. I think I would, because you look
a lot. Yeah, I'm smaller. Yeah. I'm about, I don't know, 40% smaller. So.
How are you feeling? How are you doing?
Good. I feel great. I mean, I don't want to like rehash it for everybody.
You can find, if you search your name, it's like the top things you talk about, the health issues you'd had.
I got sick a couple years ago, and my work habits were a big part of that, but also my eating habits. And, I had to have I was forced to go through a big change there, and I had to give up caffeine and sugar and salt on the same day, you know, like, to live. And I also had to stop working so much, and that wasn't so hard because when I got really sick, I couldn't work. You know, I was just like, I was dragging myself to the table like 2 or 3 hours cumulatively a day. And it was a really sort of the trough of my career. And, but today I lost a lot of weight, and I am on the proper medications to stabilize my heart function. And now my heart function is completely normal. Mm-hmm. So, and then also I had to have cornea transplants about the same time, which
was completely unrelated.
Yeah. Completely unrelated.
That is like a kick in the nuts. Like, and I'm sorry.
This is a bad summer. This is the worst summer. But yeah, it all happened in the same summer, and it was a drag. But now that I've had the cornea transplants, it's really been a miracle. Cause again, my work was really slowing down, and I had to redraw things all the time. And I was like, man, what is this? Where is this coming from? You know?
Well, sort of in that, you know, we're talking about all the stuff that you're working on, you know, here, I thought, my God, what a comeback. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had to, like, I feel like, you know, this is probably not totally healthy thinking either, but like after that, after you have like a real brush with mortality, not just like intellectually everyone's got grappled with that, but like once you have to like really face it, you're kind of like, boy, I'm on the clock here. You know, like if I want to get this workout, I need to hustle, you know?
Do you look at that in terms of like, I need to get work out, just, you know, work on stuff, you know, make my comics, do my thing? Or are you sort of on the, I need to do my great thing?
Both. I mean, because here's another little pearl of wisdom. Sometimes you can do your great thing and nobody will see it unless you have a decent profile in the business.
Right.
So like you, in order to make an impact with, something like Saga, you know, Brian Vaughn had to write some, you know, more mainstream stuff that built up that fan base of his. Mm-hmm. And that sort of goes for everybody now. You sort of have to, the people that you can point to and say, oh, look at those successful image books. Mm-hmm. Well, all those people like sort of made their bones, you know, writing Marvel and DC books. And I've tried it the other way. You know, I've tried just doing the image books. And, you know, they're well received, but not big hits.
Yeah.
And I think so. I'm never going to be that household name, but I think like to some degree, you have to keep a foot in the mainstream in order to be recognized when you do an indie project. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you still have some affection for that stuff too. So it's not like.
Oh yeah, no, it's not like I'm not toiling. It's fun. It's fun to draw Batman Beyond. Like, mm-hmm. That's right in my wheelhouse, you know? So
how do you, how is it different now? Like, how do you sort of maintain, your workflow and like trying to be, not even trying to be, like you need to be healthier? You know, like are you settled into that now? Well, do you talk to people about this all the time? Is this a
Yeah, but that's okay. if I love to work, right? And I do. I love my work. I have to realize that like part of being able to do my work is taking care of my vessel, right? Mm-hmm. Taking care of me. So if I want to work, I have to treat my body right. And that means making exercise a priority, but even more than exercise, it means being conscious of what you take in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're pulling an all-nighter, you get hungry again around 2 or 3, you know, like you want another meal at 2 or 3 in the morning and you want like caffeine to make that happen. And, you know, all those things had to be cut out of my life. And, you know, I still work a lot, but I can't pull all nighters anymore and I can't really abuse my body that way. And I do make staying healthy a priority. Mm-hmm. So in order to keep making my comics.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, you know, you have to, I imagine people just sit at that table and they'll just eat whatever is closest to hand and you know, I don't have time to make a salad or do whatever. And I've had to make a lot of these changes, not as extreme as you have, but, it's quite a thing.
I make everything I eat now, mm-hmm. you know, which is it, you know, that's a good couple hours out of your day if you're going to do that. But it has to be done because I can't eat salt like normal people do anymore. So, that's just, well, man, you know, I mean, on top of trying to stay alive for you know, my family that I love, if I want to work, that's part of working is taking care of yourself.
Do you feel better? You feel better than you ever have at this point?
Oh yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. I feel way, way healthier. I do tell you what I missed though. When I was big, I was a lot stronger. Cause I had to haul around a big old body all day.
Yeah.
So, you know, I could lift way more than I can lift now. And it's pretty startling cause I can exercise a lot longer now and I can do things I never did before, but I'm just like brute strength wise. It's not there. I just don't have that same low center of gravity and I sort of miss it. I never had to like do a double take on a door before, you know, like it's like swinging a door open. I never had to like double pump it to get it open before. And now sometimes I'm like, oh, that door requires more effort, you know?
I don't think that I ever thought of you as a juggernaut in that way, but I understand that. I, for one, I miss the very in-depth candy bar tweets, but I will take it as a trade-off.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I mean, I still have thoughts. I mean, I still have definite thoughts and opinions about those things.
It's a rough time of year for that.
Yeah. Oh, listen, I remember. I mean, I haven't had a candy bar for 2 years, but I remember what they're like. What bums me out are all the candy bars that have come out since then. The new candy bars. I know it's terrible, but I want to prove to myself that the Oreo candy bar is terrible.
You want to know? I know what you're talking. I know exactly what you're talking about. Like, I know that's going to be bad, but I need to eat it.
I need to test it.
Yeah.
Or there's like Pineapple Crush finally made it to the mainland United States, and used to be a rare treat to get Pineapple Crush. Uh-huh. And like, I can't have that now, you know. And now it's everywhere.
What do you get to have for a treat?
I don't know. Like a diet orange soda or, like oatmeal is like a big splurge for me.
Really?
Some oatmeal once in a while. Yeah. I try to stay really low carb too. Low carb, low salt, low sugar.
You are a paragon of strength.
But to be honest, I already ate like 100 years worth of that stuff.
It's true.
You know, in 48 years, I ate 100 years worth of it. So I'm just like, my pancreas is like, wow, I might make it to the end now.
Well, I'm really, really glad that you're doing well. I like that you have been sort of a constant in comics for a long time, and I hope that that stays the same way. Anything else that we want to talk about or that's coming up you want to plug?
See, I don't even, like I said before, when you're so busy, you don't remember all the things you're working on. I think my last issue of Mother Panic came out today. I do backups in Mother Panic with Jim Kruger and Andy. There will be a Shipwreck number 6 someday. There will be more issues of Blood Blister someday. We lost Tony Harris as the artist, but I'm going to pitch in and work with his inker on sort of trying to emulate his style in the future. And then look for the
Is Batman that Wade Von Graubadger?
No, it is a fella named it's a fella named Eric Layton.
It's one of my favorite names in comics, and I don't get to say it out loud all that often. So,
so you have to take.
He
your
did
shot.
Work with Tony for a lot, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He did.
Okay. Sorry.
And then, like I said, that upcoming Birdman arc of Future Quest Presents, and a few other, you know, keep your eyes peeled for a few other DC things in the Batman Beyond
and some Oni thing that we don't even know about,
and an Oni thing that's coming someday.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much. I really dug talking to you. Could have gone on for another hour easily.
Thanks, Josh. Same here.
I want to thank Phil Hester once again for joining us here on iFanboys Talksplode. Make sure to go follow Phil on Twitter and find out about all his comics. Stuff like Mythic, Shipwreck with Warren Ellis from Aftershock, classic Green Arrow run, Firebreather. It goes on and on. The guy has done a ton of comics. And also go to ifanboy.com and you can see all of our other Talksplode interviews and our regular podcasts and all the stuff we've ever done there over there over the years. It's not as much as Phil has done, but there we are. Thanks very much for listening. And again, thanks to the patrons for supporting this and bringing back these interview shows. Thanks. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means, and I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing, and some people, you know, like, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away, and, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which, again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened. But it can be tough to deal with. And also, like, one of the things is, like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.